This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 7 was recorded on May 20th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Professor Steve Keen joins me as today's All-Star interview guest. Steve, yesterday, Monday the 20th of May, Richard Vague released a new book called A Brief History of Doom. Steve, when I think about Doom, you're the guy that comes to mind. What is special about Doom, and who's Richard Vague, and what's up with the new book?
Okay. Richard Vague is quite an intriguing character. I want to talk about him as well as about the book. The book, I think, is a lovely title, A Brief History of Doom. I'm sure there was a couple of glasses chinked when they thought of that one. Of course, it's derivative, but it's very clever. And I really regard it as the successor and superior in every way to Charles Kindleberger's Manias, Panics, and Crashes and to Mackay's Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. It really gives, I think, the best verbal history of the financial crises that capitalism has experienced, and it's extremely well written and far better researched than any of those. And unlike, to some extent, Kindleberger has an explanation derived largely from Hyman Minsky, but I think Richard takes that several stages further.
Well, fantastic. So what is his novel explanation for the 1920s?
Well, you have to imagine it's his explanation in general for every crisis is very compatible with mine. In fact, the way we met each other is quite funny. He's a bookshop, avid bookshop browser, and I'll tell you about that in a while. And he said he was showing his charts about his worries about the level of mortgage debt over the 2000-2003 period to economists around the world, getting told there's no worry because, look, their assets are rising as much. So, yes, their debts are rising, but as the chief economist of Barclays told him, that's a bet I'll take any day, shortly after which he sold his credit card company to Barclays. But Richard said he sees a book called Debunking Economics, and he's now curious after this negative experience with economists, flips it open and finds his chart staring back at him. In other words, his primary explanation for financial crises is excessive private debt, a credit bubble driving that level of debt up, and then a crash when the credit bubble comes down. So that's the generic thing. But the particular thing, which was quite a surprise to me, and in fact contradicted what I thought was the case, is that the primary, at least the primary trigger for the 1920s boom that led to the 1929 bust and the Great Depression was a real estate bubble. Now, yeah, I had no idea because I'd looked at the, and people can do this themselves, look at the Robert Shiller's excellent long-term price series for American house prices going back to 1890. And you look at it and there's not much at all happening at the beginning of the 1920s. In fact, the price level dips before it happens. But according to, I'll just give a quote from the book. They said, the state of the nation's housing had become a national issue in 1921 when Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover began to advocate for increased home ownership as quote unquote, the foundation of a sound economy and social system. Hoover urged home builders to become efficient and lenders to become more generous. New tax incentives supported home construction. Banks, buildings and loans, bond houses and other lenders responded to Hoover's call. As Robert M. Fogelson reports, and I have no idea who that is, Albert E. Kleinert, again, Brooklyn's superintendent of buildings, reflected on the frenzied pace of the era when he said they, and I'll put in here the speculators, are now selling property between 12 and 1 o'clock, and then at 2 o'clock they notify the tenants that the rent will be raised, and then when they show an income gain on paper, they sell again. Now, that just sounds like the subprime all over to me, and that was actually the beginning of the trigger to the Great Depression, which he found by going back through really, really detailed history books and real estate records that I don't think anybody's ever read before.
Okay, so what actually causes financial crises, according to Richard Vague?
Fundamentally, too much private debt rising too rapidly in the prelude. So he says he's got a research team behind him, self-financed, and he's very well-financed, I might add, self-financed research team that has painstakingly gone through records of 150 economic crises pretty much over the last 1.5 centuries around the world. And they said in every last case, the crisis occurred when private debt had risen to or reached or passed through 150% of GDP, and when the increase in credit over the change in debt over the previous 3 to 5 years was of the order of 20% of GDP. Now, the 2008 crisis ticks that box. So does the Great Depression. So did Japan's crisis. And he then goes into detail to those and three other crises.
How did he develop this analysis?
It comes out of him being a leading banker. It's an interesting story as to how he made his fortune, which we'll talk about shortly. But he was running a consumer finance company, one of two credit card companies he established. And as part of that, he was getting very detailed data on the level of mortgage debt. And he said, just watching it, I think between 2000 and 2003, saw that mortgage debt rose from $6 trillion to $9 trillion. He just was horrified at how high the rate of growth of debt was. And he was worried that his own credit card customers wouldn't be able to pay their credit card debt. Then he went talking to economists about it and kept on being reassured there was no problem. And he simply didn't trust their reassurances. So he actually sold out completely out of the banking business, sold his second credit card company to Barclays sometime in the early 2000s. And therefore, he sat back and watched the whole crisis completely insulated from it.
Steve, tell us a little bit more about Richard Veig. How did he become wealthy and become a banker? What's his backstory?
Well, his interest in life was actually art. He wanted to be an artist and realized that art didn't make any money, so he went into banking. And this is in Texas. He's got a wonderful, very rich Texan drawl. And in the late 1970s, ended up being the manager of the consumer wing of one of the many Texas banks that was lending to Texas oil drillers at the time. And of course, there was a huge boom going on. That was the second OPEC crisis. Oil had risen from $10 a barrel to $40. Well, then, of course, there was too much oil being drilled. All the North Sea oil, et cetera, came online. And all those banks started to go bankrupt as their customers simply couldn't, the price plunged from $40 back to about $10 again. They were all totally wiped out. Now, of course, in that situation, the banks were trying to sell any assets they had at any value whatsoever. And here he is running the consumer wing. So they were trying to sell the consumer wing. Now, he said his business as a banker, he says, you go to the board or you go to the go to the public and say what a wonderful company it is, and you turn around and remove all the garbage is in the background at the same time. So he found that he could actually, first of all, take advantage of a leverage buyout. So he raised the funds for the leverage buyout. Then he found that I don't quite remember the details, he told me this personally, but there was a second little loophole that let him get a really higher than the normal level of leverage one can get for a leverage buyout. Having done that, unlike most of these people who were just basically asset stripping their companies, he was there to make it profitable. So he went back and then just cleaned out all the garbage loans, all the stuff that was dangerous, got rid of anything which was not going to be successful. This is consumer loans after all, and turned it into a profitable company. So he managed to do a dramatic, something in the order of 20 or 30 times increase in the money he'd taken out to buy the credit card company in the first place. Then he did the same thing again with the second company, not quite as large again, but he purchased another firm, built it up. Then he actually got involved in energy coupons. And then after all that, he's now retired from banking and is now working as both a venture capitalist and a philanthropist in Philadelphia.
And presumably, he's got a pretty good art collection going by now. So what's your relationship with him? Have you met him personally?
Yeah, it's a long story. I, out of the blue, got an email in Australia about, 2010 or 11, I think, asking me to come to speak at a conference in Washington organized by The Atlantic. And then I said I hadn't heard for a while, wrote back, and yes, sir, please come over. And this strange name, Richard Veig, which, of course, I fell over, as you can imagine. So I fly in from Sydney, land in Washington. We're meeting up with the organizers. There's Richard. And I made a comment and said, I'm feeling a bit vague after the flight. Well, beetroot red with embarrassment, but he's so used to it, he just doesn't even wash with him anymore. And then sometime after that, he asked me, when he spoke at that conference, I hopped up with one of the audience and said, this is the first time I've sat in the audience hearing what I felt was me speaking at me, because he was using exactly the same analysis I used, too much private debt, causing a level of excessive dependence upon credit busting because people can't finance the loans they've taken out, Ponzi scheme stuff has been financed, that falls over. And the other dynamics, I've done my mathematical modeling. Of course, he wasn't talking about that, but that's so consistent with my way of thinking. Then in 2012 or 13, I think it was, he invited me to come over and work with him for a month to see if I could build up a long-term database of America's private debt, which we did. He's since improved upon that, and also try to find data on China, and that was simply impossible to find anything really reliable. And then since then, We've been in touch through the whole Institute for New Economic Thinking. We've spoken at the same conferences. He's been a chairperson on sessions that I've spoken at, and we've become friends, and he also supports me on Patreon. So I have a very strong relationship with him, but I would be, as you think you know with me, I'd be saying this anyway because I simply think it's an exceptionally good piece of work.
Well, he sounds like a fascinating guy. We'll have to look into getting him on the program. I can't make any commitments, and I don't mean to be vague about our degree of commitment. Couldn't resist. Steve, I love the way you always have interesting little twists to share with us. So I really look forward to getting you on again in a couple of weeks. We're going to have to leave it there this week in the interest of time. Listeners, for your next installment of Macro Voices All-Stars, we've got Kevin Muir coming up on Friday morning. So stay tuned for that. For Macro Voices, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. Also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.